I'm Tony Gosling, Dialect is Bristol's first podcast, set up with a grant from the Scarman Trust way back in 2002. Has been broadcast on Preston, Swindon and St Albans Community Radio, as well as here in Bristol. This week, we talked to Brett Sparks from Unite in the southwest of England, the Union. Also, Ian, who's been living in his car. We've had him on before. It's just really an update to see how he's getting on being homeless. But we start this week by talking to Rose Crossland from Bristol CND. Hi, Rose. Welcome to Dialect.
Hello.
Tell us a bit about CND. I thought this was an organisation that pretty much failed. It was very popular in the 1970s and 80s, maybe a bit before that, with the origins of Britain getting atomic weapons in the 1950s. But I thought it had fizzled out, but you haven't, have you?
No, not at all. I think a lot of people seem to have the impression that when the American cruise missiles went back and Greenham Common closed, Greenham Common Peace Camp closed down, that CND's job was done. But of course, the United Kingdom still has, and has to this day, a nuclear weapon system, an enormous, very, very expensive nuclear weapon system called Trident, which recently has been in the news a lot more, partly because of the fact that the vote on whether or not to invest, or whether or not to waste, in my view, up to £167 billion on developing and implementing the next generation of weapons of mass destruction, that vote is going to be taking place sometime this spring. So it's very much a current issue. It's not a dead issue.
Well, a lot of people will say that nuclear weapons have actually kept the peace since the end of World War II.
Yes, well, there hasn't been a world war since the end of World War II, and we've had nuclear weapons since the end of World War II. That doesn't in any way mean there's a causal relationship between the two. And in fact, my view and the view of a lot of military experts, technical experts and other people is that it's more by luck than judgment that we haven't had a terrible accident in during that time. And the simple existence of these weapons massively increases. You know, the more nuclear weapons you have, the greater the possibility of an accident.
Now, you may be right, actually, because I was reading this week that 50 years ago this week, in Spain, the Americans dropped four hydrogen bombs. Well, sort of by mistake, really. They were on an aircraft that crashed. One of them they lost. And we've got this rather nasty situation, haven't we, where some of the nuclear weapons have been decommissioned and others have actually gone missing one way or another, maybe on an aircraft that's ditched in the sea, a bit like the James Bond Thunderball film, you know, and there's it's not been really possible to keep tabs on every single nuclear weapon. We've also had recently the North Koreans blowing up a hydrogen bomb. They've had other atomic weapons before that. So what about this idea of the sort of almost like a black market in this in nuclear weapons? Do you think there's such a thing?
I think the more nuclear weapon systems there are in the world, and also actually the more nuclear power stations there are in the world, the more fissile material there is floating around, and some of it will find its way onto the black market and does. There's a very good film by an organisation called Global Zero called Countdown to Zero. They're an American based organisation that worked for multilateral nuclear disarmament, but that film contains some terrifying facts about the uncontrolled an illegal sale of fissile material around the world and the risks that actually we've been facing constantly. And in fact, in that film, they explain that when people have been found selling this material on the black market, it's never been because that they were actually being looked for. It's just been serendipity. It's just been luck. There's been a police raid on someone that was, I don't know, selling knocked off car batteries or something, and it turns out, oh, and he's selling some fissile material as well.
Well, we've recently had the report, if you can call it that, about the former Russian spy Alexander Litvinenko, and he was poisoned with polonium-210. Now, apparently, this is something that you can only get through nuclear power stations, and I imagine, you know, you would probably be one of the first people to say that, well, the nuclear power program probably wouldn't be there if it wasn't for the fact that there were weapons at the end of it.
That is definitely my view, that historically that was the reason that the UK nuclear power industry was developed. And of course now we're in a very, very different world, a very different situation.
Tell me what you do as a group nowadays then.
Actually, one of our main activities in the last few years has been, sounds an odd thing, we've been running a film competition for young people to try and encourage young people to be thinking about nuclear weapons and to be considering the possibility of freeing the world from nuclear weapons rather than just accepting it as a done deal. You know, they were there since I was born, so they're always going to be there. We run our film competition, and this year we'll be adding art and writing sections to that competition as well. So it's basically whatever creative output young people are producing. If you go to our Bristol CND's website at www.bristolcnd.org.uk, there's links to the film competition and all the other activities.
I mean, it is amazingly relevant. This is the thing that shocks me, is that we sort of trot this figure of whatever it is, about 180 billion, is it? Or how much?
Well, until fairly recently, people used to think about £100 billion would be the cost, including the initial capital cost and the ongoing running costs.
This for is
the
Trident.
Trident replacement system, the successor system. But actually, last year, there was a Tory minister did a reassessment of that and came up with the figure now of £167 billion.
Crikey, okay, so yeah, £167 billion. Yeah. That's a lot of our time and effort going into this. Even some military people say they're not quite sure how it would ever be used. But anyway, so it's still very much an interesting thing to talk about, particularly since so much of our cash apparently is going to go on it. So you're organising a meeting, aren't you? Just tell us about that.
Yeah, well, this is actually jointly, this meeting is being organised by us, Bristol CND, and Stop the War Coalition, and the Bristol People's Assembly. And that's the Bristol People's Assembly Against Austerity in particular. That is the reason that we are all so interested in this subject, is the cost opportunity loss as well as the simple moral argument.
Hang on. What do you mean by that?
Weapons.
The cost opportunity loss. I don't think I've ever heard those three words together.
Well, there are many reasons for opposing nuclear weapons, and there's a simple moral argument that they're weapons of mass destruction, and even if they were free, they'd be wrong. But there's another strong argument, which is made by a lot of people, that at £167 billion is simply too expensive, and it's a very ridiculously inefficient way of spending on defence. I think it was General Bramall that said they're militarily useless.
I think I don't know how you'd use a nuke against a terrorist. I'm not sure how, if they would even feature.
Yeah, I mean, they're a weapon that can never be used.
Although the Russians say there is no such thing as international terrorism. He said that it's all being, a lot of the terrorism we see today is being done by mercenaries and paid private military companies are being hired to do a lot of the stuff that we call terrorism. Anyway, that's the Russian view. Mm. So are you a bit of a fan of the Russians, a Putin fan? Some might call you a traitor.
Personally, no, I'm not particularly a fan of Putin or of Russia.
So yours is a pretty moral principle. Anyway, tell us who's going to be at this meeting and a bit about them.
It's a speaker meeting, it's called Stop Trident, Stop the Bombing, and Welfare, Not Warfare. The argument being that the money spent on Trident could and should be spent on other things. And we've got a really good lineup of nationally known speakers coming. First of all, we've got Rebecca Johnson, who is very well known through her work for CND. She's also well known as the founder of the Acronym Institute for Disarmament Diplomacy, and she's worked for decades in the field of international arms negotiations. She was senior advisor to Hans Blix in 2006 on the United Nations WDM committee, for example. And she's also done work very recently on, I think it is also a UN report into the humanitarian impact of nuclear weapons. So she's a real expert on the legal background and the diplomatic background to nuclear weapons internationally. And she's a very significant international figure. We've also got John Rees, who is, again, national officer in Stop the War. He's also well known for his role in the People's Assembly Against Austerity. He's coming down from London to speak as well. And we've got Shara Ali, the deputy leader of the Green Party, will be speaking. So that's three national figures. And we also have a good local Bristol voice. We've got Labour Party councillor Mary Threlfall from Eastville, who will be also on the panel.
OK, fantastic. And just remind us again of the title.
Stop Trident, Stop the Bombing, Welfare, Not Warfare.
I guess this is also, I know that, I don't know if CND gets involved in any of this, but a lot of the British arms firms are making a lot of money out of Yemen at the moment. They're selling stuff to not just bombs, but also aircraft and spares and things like that to the Saudi Arabians. Mm. Do you think the Saudi royal family's got long for this world?
Who knows?
Maybe, maybe not. But anyway, it's a similar sort of an industry, isn't it?
Mm. Yeah, yes, indeed. Although I think, you know, nuclear weapons are definitely a special case in the sense that they cannot be targeted. They can only be used as weapons of mass destruction.
Do you think it's possible to get rid of nuclear weapons?
I think in the same way that we've got rid of biological weapons, we've made them illegal. We no longer spend people's tax money on designing and building biological weapons, and we shouldn't be deliberately, as a country, paying our taxes in order
don't
to
governments
design and
just
build
farm
these
this
things.
Sort of work out to private companies now.
But it's our tax money that's being paid for.
I know,
for
but
it.
So much of this stuff seems to be being done by private military companies now, and you know, it's all kind of the privatisation of the military is a bit worrying.
Yes, I do agree.
Anyway, just let us know whereabouts and when you meet and when the meeting's taking place.
Yeah, OK, Rose. Well, the speaker meeting is, the public speaker meeting with the national figures is on Tuesday the 2nd of February. It's at 7 o'clock onwards and it's at the Trinity Centre in Easton. And I would like to say that the reason we're holding this speaker meeting now is it's all part of building up towards a massive anti-Trident, anti-nuclear demonstration that's going to be taking place in London on Saturday the 27th of February, so towards the end of February. This is being organised nationally. Telegraph today was saying that they're expecting 50,000 people to be turning up in Trafalgar Square at the end of February to listen to Jeremy Corbyn speak about nuclear weapons. And it's because the government are going to be forcing the vote on whether or not to renew Trident very shortly, that this protest is being held now. And everything we're doing at the moment is building towards this big protest. We'll be running buses, coaches from Bristol up to London for the day on
Saturday.
Will
there be time to do a bit of shopping?
No, I don't think so. I think it will be too busy listening, and I think there'll be too many people to get through to get to the
shops.
Well,
you might be able to just dash up to Foyle's bookshop or something up Charing Cross Road and buy a couple of books and have a quick look around before you get back to see our great leader. No, he's not our leader, is he? He's Jeremy Corbyn, leader of the opposition, that's right, speaking at Trafalgar Square. But just remind us how people can get hold of the group locally, Rose, for either the demo or the speaker meeting.
Okay, well, our website's the easiest thing. It's got links to everything else and contact details and phone number, and that's www.bristolcnd.org.uk. We do have a phone number if people don't use the internet at all, 075 272 95109. And also specifically about the speaker meeting and the coach up to London, there's some Facebook event pages which you can get to from tinyurl.com/StopTridentBristol.
Fantastic. Just give us that phone number again and we'll give it again at the end of the show, Rose.
075 272 95109.
Rose Crossland from Bristol CND, thanks very much for joining us on Dialect.
Thank you very much.
dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
And now I'm joined by Brett Sparks from Unite Communities. Now, sounds great, Unite Communities. What is it, Brett?
Unite Communities was set up by Unite the Union back in 2012, then part of 2012. Initially, the idea was to give people not in paid work the opportunity to join a trade union and to use the trade union for their voice for their campaigns.
So is it for volunteers? I mean, because we're volunteers on this show.
Absolutely.
Maybe we could join.
Absolutely. It's for the membership criteria is for people who are not in paid work. So that includes the retired, stay-at-home parents, carers, volunteers, students, etc.
How much do you have to pay to join?
It's a nominal fee of 50p a week. It's just a nominal fee because we are a membership organisation.
So
it's
kind of £25 a year-ish.
Yeah, £26 a year.
But what do you actually do, Brett?
Well, we've become a bit of a campaigning arm for Unite the Union across the country, and we've been campaigning on lots of various issues. Some of them are very localised, and I can give you examples of those. Some of them have got a more national feel to them.
Where did Unite come from? Was it other unions merging, old-fashioned unions?
Yeah, it was a merger about 8 years ago now of the old Transport and General Workers Union and Amicus, which was the union which used to service members in the finance industry, manufacturing, engineers, etc., print industry, etc.
Okay, so how many members do you actually have in the Southwest?
Community members in the Southwest, we have about 1,600 now. So that's been built up over the last 3 years.
I mean, people will obviously be thinking, well, if I join Unite Communities, what's in it for me?
Yeah, well, there's lots of things in it for them. There are lots of issues out there which affect local people. And issues that people get angry about.
Give us an idea of some of the things you've been campaigning around then.
Yeah, certainly. I mean, in North Devon recently, we've been running a campaign to help save some community hospital beds from closure. In Bristol, we've been heavily involved in the Save the Bush Residential Centre campaign. We ran the campaign to get the women's only swimming session at Hawfield from a couple of years ago. That was ours. Beginning of last year, end of the year before, we campaigned heavily in Devon to save the youth service from closure.
Have you been successful in any of those campaigns?
Indeed, the Hawfield swimming campaign. We made sure that the council came to us and spoke to us, and eventually the women's session was put on.
I mean, if you're juggling around with hours or something, that may be a lot easier than actually stopping public services from closing completely because of all the budget cuts after the 2008 bailouts. You know, all the money going to the banks and nothing left for the rest of us. There seems to be a fantastic rollback in the public services.
There is. There's been a massive cutback on public services, and people are suffering up and down the country, and you can see the extent of that just by walking through the streets of Bristol. But what we don't want to do is we're not saying we're an alternative to public services, because we're not doing that. What we're saying is that if there is a service or if there is an issue in your area and you feel strongly about it, we will help you support you.
So I suppose the idea is, you tell me if I'm right or wrong here, but you're helping focus people in the right direction to get what they want. So yeah, the idea is that it comes from the grassroots up, I suppose.
Absolutely. Absolutely. We don't determine which campaigns are for. That's decided by the membership in the local areas. So, for instance, if a group of members came to us and said, look, there's been, for an example, there's been some children knocked over outside of school, we think there should be 20 mile an hour speed limit, will you help us campaign on that? Absolutely, we'll go along, we'll help them produce their literature, their leaflets, we'll train them to teach them how to run a successful campaign, and to make sure that the people who make the decisions get a choice, get to listen to the person on the street.
Now, some people will say the politicians don't listen until it gets into the media, particularly mainstream media like the BBC. So is that your experience, that that's a large part of making things happen?
It can be. It has a part of it. But
The Daily Mail. Well, if something appears in the Daily Mail, things seem to move fairly quickly.
Well, there's to get it in the national press, we have done that. For instance, you may remember the campaign against ATOS that ran a few years ago, which we supported and we effectively ran in the South West.
These are the people who were doing work
capability assessments. The company were profiting basically off of people's inability to work.
I remember it, they weren't using doctors, they were using people who weren't actually trained to
absolutely
assess whether somebody was capable or not.
Absolutely.
And sometimes they were actually putting down inaccurate things. So someone would say, no, I can't do that. And then they put down, yes, they can. And as a result, they would lose their benefits.
Absolutely. And we had lots of people come to us and say, look, this is not right and this is wrong. And we'd advise them, this is the process you have to go through to make an appeal. And the majority of those appeals were upheld. Once we got in front of a doctor and a lawyer, they were upheld.
You know what? I think it's great what you're doing, because you're helping people to have the confidence to fight for their rights. And a lot of the time is they're being bullied by the system, aren't they?
Well, people, bullying is a strong word, but people do feel vulnerable and unable to change the society around them.
If someone's threatening to take away benefits, that could mean you get evicted. That's a form of bullying.
That's a threat. That's very threatening behaviour, isn't it? But what we want to do is we want to make sure that these people have not only the confidence to take on the issues, but also, you know, the ability and the knowledge on how to do it.
Some will say, well, I'm sorry, Brett, but there just isn't the money to go around anymore.
Some may say that, but we did find out there's an awful lot of money that was flying around to save the banks. I think it was 1.2 trillion, I think, that was put in from the UK government to save the banking system. So, if we look at the Bush campaign, for instance, to save the beds there for, which are respite beds, basically, for families with severely disabled children.
Okay, so this is
£300,000.
So this is so that people can have a few nights every once in a while where they don't have to care for their own severely disabled child.
Absolutely,
or
yeah.
it just gives them a little break from it, because it can be incredibly wearing looking after a disabled person 24/7.
Absolutely.
What's the latest with that campaign then?
Well, the campaign's still continuing. The Bush campaign is obviously, the Bush is at threat. It's going to lose those beds, but we're still fighting for some decent alternative that fits the bill for them.
This £300,000 for the Bush is a bit cheeky, really, because the mayor could afford to pay for that out of his own pocket, couldn't he?
Well, it's when you put it into consideration, the amount that's being spent on 20-mile-an-hour speed limits signs, I think sometimes people need to prioritise their concerns.
Amazing. So the campaign's ongoing for the Bush. Anyone that's interested in finding out more about that, is there any way to keep up with that and other campaigns you're doing?
Certainly, yeah. They can contact us direct through the Unite website, which is www.unitetheunion.org. They can find my contact details on there. They can contact me. And we can invite them along, meet the members of the Bristol area community branch.
And how often do you meet and where?
There's different branches and groups up and down the southwest. The Bristol area group, which consists of members in Bristol, Bath, Weston-super-Mare, Wells, etc. They meet in Victoria Street once a month.
Is that at the old trade union?
The old
T&G building.
Yeah, now the Unite building, Tony Benn House.
Yeah. Just remind us again how often. And the other thing is, I do worry a little bit, because what about for people that aren't on the internet? Everyone sort of says, oh, go onto the internet and find this website, or email as well. There are quite a lot of people out there that either can't afford or just simply don't have internet access.
I know, and I saw a scary statistic a couple of years ago that said 20% of the people in the southwest have never actually been on the internet. So that's I can understand that perfectly.
Good luck to them.
If they're in Bristol, if they are in Bristol,
it can suck you in. I'm afraid
it keeps you off of Facebook. It's doing you a favour. No, if they are in central Bristol and they want to pop into Tony Benn House in Victoria Street, then they can pick up leaflets with my contact details on, and if I'm about, I'm more than happy to have a chat with them.
Okay, Brett. Just finish by reminding us of the website again, though.
Yep, certainly. It's www.unitetheunion.org.
Brett Sparks from Unite Communities, thanks very much for joining us on Dialect.
Thank you very much.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk. UK.
So now I'm joined by Ian, who's been living in his car. Hi, Ian. Welcome back to Dialect. We have you on air about once a month now at the moment, don't we?
Yeah, it seems to be. Yes, I've endured some of the winter, but I had a break of it for 5 weeks.
Now, you've been away, haven't you? You must be probably Bristol's only homeless person who's just had a great holiday abroad.
Yes, I had 5 weeks in Japan, Thailand, and I met up with my brother who graciously paid for the flight. And I had a lovely 5 weeks in Thailand and Japan.
Well, tell us a bit about both those countries.
Japan, the only country to have two nuclear bombs dropped on it and survive. They've still got part of what was bombed in Hiroshima is a museum where you can actually go and see what was left from the devastation of the bomb dropped by Enola Gay.
So it's a little bit like Bristol in a way. In the city centre, we've got the burnt-out church in Castle Park, haven't we?
That's right, yeah.
Which is a kind of living memorial of a war which some people would rather we forget about. Do you think there's any lessons learned from Hiroshima and Nagasaki?
Yeah. Yeah, there is. Don't drop nuclear bombs.
So why are we spending all this? I mean, we were just hearing from Rose earlier on, from CND, to spend $167 billion, I think she said, roughly, on Trident.
Well, Trident is coming up for replacement. Trident is the only deterrent that the United Kingdom can afford. The Russians are also investing heavily in new technology, new long-range missiles like Trident.
I noticed the Americans are also refitting all their nuclear weapons in Europe, almost like they're preparing for war.
They're not preparing for war. What they're doing is they're replacing the older weapons as they come to the end of their service lives with newer weapons. In fact, since the 1950s, the Ministry of Defence have got a location in Wiltshire where they constantly develop from the original nuclear weapons we had in the 50s and the 60s up until Polaris and now Trident and now Trident 2.
We talk about nukes quite a lot on this show. We had Lawrence DeMello, who's a former Discovery Channel producer who lives out in Argentina, recently saying that she thinks that Winston Churchill was a prime mover in the British atomic bomb, because he went out of politics, didn't he? 1945, the Labour Party got in and the Socialists got in. But Winston Churchill wasn't idle. He was busy doing the British atomic bomb.
Right. Yeah, yeah. And then we brought him back as Prime Minister.
What was most surprising, though, about Churchill was no one was quite sure where he got the money from to do the bomb. And some would say some of it might have been deals for Nazi gold.
No, Churchill was too straight to be involved with anything corrupt like that.
Well, he was talking about nuking Moscow, wasn't he? He said maybe we should use a nuclear
Kenny
bomb.
Kenny Everett made a joke about bombing Moscow.
So, but it wasn't a joke. This is a US intelligence report which came out last year about Churchill seriously saying, but to end the Cold War, we need to drop a nuclear weapon on Moscow.
Well, that's why we've got nuclear weapons, to stop the Russians dropping their nuclear bombs on us.
And that's why they've got nukes
to stop
Churchill. Anyway, look, your main hobby is plane spotting. That's why you're out in Japan. Did you see any nice aeroplanes?
Oh, yes. 85 Boeing 787 Dreamliners.
You could go and see them at Bristol Airport, can't you?
Not the quantity and the quality that I got.
You've got to have them all in a row.
You've got to have quality. You've got to have quality and quantity, and you don't get them sat at Dave's plane spotting at Love's Gate.
So, yes, but so are you a Boeing fan rather than an Airbus fan?
Yep.
Why?
Because if it ain't Boeing, I ain't going.
Unfortunately, Boeing's not doing too well. Airbus seems to be grabbing loads more orders. Also, they are our homegrown Filton airliner manufacturers, aren't they?
And they're also the reason why Concorde isn't flying anymore.
Airbus?
Yes.
Why?
They own the operating rights. They owned the drawings, technical support drawings, to keep Concorde flying. If the British ones had flown first, then Concorde would still be flying. But because the French ones flew first, that gave the French the holdings on Concorde. You see, the trouble was Air France could never make any money flying Concorde because British Airways had the hour advantage going from Heathrow to New York and Washington, D.C.
But, I mean, hang on a minute, because you could get all of the passengers from other cities in round Europe and bring them into Paris and take them across to New York.
Yeah, but Concorde can only carry 144 passengers maximum.
Right, so you just jack the price up. You make even more money at it.
Yeah, and the trouble is British Airways are now making more money doing two flights a day from London City to Shannon and then on to New York and Washington with two A318s rather than all the time they had Concorde. The trouble was Concorde was built in the 60s and the noise regulations that were coming in, that's what really killed Concorde off. Plus you had September the 11th and the business travel after September
the
11th.
No, surely. It was the crash.
It was the fact.
Where was the crash? Just remind us.
France. Paris. Didn't it
hit something on a runway or something?
It hit a sliver of metal, burst a tyre. And unlike the British Airways ones, who were modified for that happening, the Air France ones wasn't. So what happened was, as Concorde went down the runway, it hit the sliver of metal, the tyre burst, shredding hot rubber straight into the wing and straight into the fuel tank. The fuel leaked out of the fuel tanks into the engines, causing a fire and kaboom. British Airways had the modification where they had water deflectors on their Concordes because they had several incidences in America where they'd burst a tyre and the tyre had gone up and hit the wing.
Do you think old Concorde will ever fly again?
No.
Why are you so certain?
Because the world's moved on since the 60s. Concorde's nice to look at. It's a thing in the past.
But it's not just nice to look at, is it? It's actually very practical.
Anyone
who wants to get across the Atlantic quickly, that's the way to do it.
Yeah, but it's had its day. The noise regulators now has killed Concorde off.
I mean, couldn't you maybe use an airport, not necessarily Heathrow, which is away from maybe, you know, sort of nearer the coast or something like that?
No. Modern military aircraft have political correct engines, so you can't get away with that argument, but no.
It's funny because you used to always be able to tell when Concorde went over because of the noise.
11 o'clock and half past seven.
Well, it was the noise. It was always a bit more noisy than the others. You'd look up and you'd think, there it is. There she is. Even though there were loads of them, you'd look up and that, there, it's Concorde. There's only one.
Yeah, you could also tell the time by it. 11 o'clock in the morning and half past seven at night was the time that Concorde went over Bristol.
Amazing. Anyway, look, what about these F-35s? These are the very expensive US planes that apparently the Brits are now going to be buying some of.
Yes, we bought 178 of them.
Well, we've said we're going to buy them.
No, we've actually...
The money's changed hands. Yes. This is good old George Osborne. He's always got money in the treasury for this sort of thing, but never for... the basic, you know, sort of services, things like libraries. Anyway.
Actually, it was the Ministry of Defence that bought the aircraft, not the Chancellor.
But they had to have a word with George,
yes,
didn't
George
they?
George had to.
So, why are you a bit sceptical about the F-35?
It's a disaster. The latest two disasters that struck the F-35 programme is people who weigh 136 pounds... cannot eject from the aircraft in the event of a crash because they suffer whiplash. There's a design fault on the Martin Baker ejector seats.
Well, they just stick a new ejector seat. That sounds pretty simple.
Well, they just stick heavier people in it. And another disaster is that the Americans have just voted to keep the A-10 tank buster in service.
But why does that affect the F-35 at all?
Because the F-35 program need 1,000 experienced crew chiefs and maintainers to maintain the thing.
Oh dear! So it's going to be very expensive if we do.
It is a maintenance heavy aircraft.
Good, isn't it? That's good for the manufacturers because it means that we have to keep coming back to them buying these expensive bits for it.
But unfortunately, the Canadians have just voted a new government in, and they were voted in on a program of cancelling the Canadian F-35 order. So if that happens, the F-35s go up by $1 million per plane.
Each one can't stop. How much do they cost each at the moment then?
I wouldn't like to say, but I know the astronomical figure is, the cost of them are astronomical. One of the presidential candidates have actually said that if he gets elected president, he will cancel the F-35 program.
Well, it sounds to me like the cost of this thing is just going up. Maybe we should call this the incredibly expensive military waste of money show. Because we were talking about Trident earlier. Now this as well. It seems like they'll find any amounts of our money to buy these things.
So and 15% of it is built in England.
The other thing with the F-35, I remember reading, is that it had a bit of a dogfight with an old 1970s plane called the F-16, didn't it?
Yep, the F-16.
This is just in trials, by
the way. This is a very early F-35 prototype, which has not got the latest software. It did a dogfight with an F-16 and lost. The pilot of the F-35 was heard to say, "This thing can't fly out of a paper bag."
Oh dear. Well, why is that? Is it just not so manoeuvrable or not so quick or what?
It's a case of the software on that particular aircraft is not up to the latest spec.
And also, if you do an internet search for the F-35, you'll find just before Christmas some cracks appeared in the wings.
Yep, that's another. That's another.
Oops. So don't go around a corner too quick or your wing might fall off.
It's a case of every aircraft has cracks in it. In fact, Airbus has just discovered yet more cracks in the...
So do you reckon this isn't too dangerous then?
No. Airbus, most A380s have got cracks in the wing.
I wouldn't fly on an A380 if I thought it had cracks in the wing.
A lot of people... Like who fly on aircraft don't know the faults of them. The Boeing Dreamliner has a computer fault which needs to be shut down every 248 days.
The other thing is, I mean, Britain's got rid of all its Harriers to America over the last few years. That was, I think, about 3 or 4 years ago. Yeah. Tell us about that.
The Harriers are another labour-intensive aircraft. And because they were jointly operated by the Royal Navy and the Royal Air Force at RAF Cottesmore in Leicestershire, the old annual who's paying the maintenance bill cropped up. So it was basically the Royal Navy wouldn't pay for the maintenance on their Harriers.
But we paid loads of money to get these things up to scratch, and then we said, oh, yeah, well, let's sell them off cheap.
We got a fair return for the money of what we invested in the Harrier program. But yes, they're currently sat in Arizona.
Can we have them back?
No. From the pictures I've seen of them recently, the best parts of them have gone. They're basically just fuselages sat on trestles.
Okay, so any more aviation gossip?
Some good news on the F-35 program. Funny enough, they're coming to Fairford, Farnborough, and Yeovilton air shows this summer.
Is there a guarantee the wings will stay on?
Guaranteed it. Well, you never know with the F-35. Apparently, they could bring them over by boat, or they could fly them over in a C-5. So, we'll wait and see.
Let's cut to the chase, Ian. How are you getting on with finding somewhere to live?
I'm still home.
Living in the car, how's that been?
Well, it's been, since I'm returning my holiday, it's been rather cold and rather wet.
Whereabouts are you able to stay somewhere sensible?
I stay somewhere. I've got a safe and secure place in Bristol.
Had any more trouble with the police?
I haven't seen the police since I came back off my holidays.
They've left you alone. And now, how about South Gloucestershire Council? Are they any closer to offering you somewhere?
I've had a couple of meetings with South Gloucestershire Council on my return, and things are being put in place to help me get an accommodation.
Well, let us know how that all goes.
Okay,
look,
Tony.
Finally, I said finally already, but there's another finally, and that is rendition, because this is some area that actually plane spotters like you were very helpful to journalists like me in saying, hang on, we've just seen a plane landing or taking off at a certain airfield, and often the journalists would know, that's one of those rendition planes where illegal prisoners were being taken around the world to secret prisons.
I was at Stansted Airport the day the Libyan who was charged with the Lockerbie bombing was returned to Libya. And that was, he was flown back on a standard Libyan Airways flight. But yeah, there are several companies that do work for the American military.
Are they CIA companies? Are they, what are those
just
people?
Normal.
Mercenary companies?
No, they're just normal.
They smuggle drugs too?
No. They're just normal aviation companies. Like when Abu Hamza, when he was flown from RAF Mildenhall in Suffolk.
You mean after he stopped working for MI6?
Yeah. A bit like Martin McGuinness working for MI6 as well. So, you know. When the Hook was flown from Mildenhall to New York, he was flown on a private business jet chartered by the American Air Force.
But a lot of these people who were being ferried around the world were just people who'd been grabbed by soldiers for a bounty. It didn't matter whether they'd done anything wrong. They were just in the wrong place at the wrong time.
Exactly.
So do you think that there's still an important role for people like yourself, for plane spotters, in actually making the news? I mean, I've seen some of these have made major headline news, some of these.
Plane spotters make the news for all the wrong reasons, i.e. being arrested in charge, you're doing things that is illegal in that country. I've been lucky over the years. I've been to countries like Israel, Greece, America, a lot of European countries. The only trouble I really had was in 1988 when I was nearly killed at an air show in Germany.
Tell us about that.
The Italian air display team, Freghi Tricolori, were doing a manoeuvre. There was five aircraft flying one way, four flying the other one, and one pilot was supposed to go through or underneath. When he got his timing wrong, crashed into four other aircraft and killed 80 people on the ground.
And that was quite close, wasn't
it? That was close, yes. I was in the beer tent coming out.
So that was a bit of a close shot.
Yeah, it was. Yeah, it's too close for comfort. But that is the risk of our hobby, of going to see, you know, you touch wood that you never, ever see a plane crash. I've seen two in 40 years.
Well, anyway, let's hope next time you're doing your plane spotting, or maybe by the time that the air tattoo Fairford comes up, that you're actually living somewhere not in your car, Ian.
Well, so do I.
And thanks very much for coming
okay,
in
cheers.
And keeping us up to date.
Cheers, Tony.
Well, that's all for this week. Dialect is Bristol's first weekly MP3 podcast, broadcast on community radio stations in Bristol, Swindon, Preston and St Albans over the years. If you're online, you can subscribe to our emails or download the podcast from dialectradio.co.uk. Thanks to this week's guests. We started with Rose Crossland from Bristol CND, and as promised, I'll give her mobile number again for Bristol CND, both for the talk and also for the demo in London. That's 07527 295 109. That's 07527 295 109. Also, we had Brett Sparks from Unite Communities, and that is Unite the Union. You can get hold of him through there. Or also, go and say hello at Tony Benn House on Victoria Street in between Bristol Bridge and Bristol Templemead stations if you're living in Bristol. And Ian, who's been living in his car, the plane spotter. Thanks very much for popping in again, Ian. Hopefully, next time he pops in, maybe in about a month's time, he'll have somewhere to live, a flat from South Gloucestershire Council. And also thanks to studio engineer Dave Bazanko. Dialect to Bristol Broadband Co-op production, and anyone can contribute. Just contact us through Volunteering Bristol on 0117 989 7733 or at bristolvolunteers.org.uk. That was Dialect, and I'm Tony Gosling, wishing you a very good week. Thanks for listening. So until the same time next week, goodbye for now.